That's better. I've got a microphone on now. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for coming back. Got a couple of people who have other commitments this afternoon. So they've already let us know that they can't be with us for this session. So just a reminder that the sessions are being recorded. They'll be on the resource page as and when we can get them uploaded. Yesterday's teachings were already there, and some of the material that I've been referring to also I'll upload to the resource page, which I hope will be helpful. There were some things I wanted to catch up on to begin with. Just some maybe little things that I've been kind of mentioning and saying, but I haven't had images of, but I've managed to find some images. So it's a bit random, but these are things that we've referred to before. So I'm just going to share a screen. Let's go in there. Okay, so this is a Chenrezig mandala. There's Buddha Chenrezig in the middle. And what I wanted to show you on here was the eight-level gate. So up here we have one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. So these are the eight levels that were the eight jhanas that we finished this morning's teaching with. That's just to show you an eight-level gate. They're not so common, but there's one, just so that you can see what's going on there. I thought it might be interesting to show you some other types of mandalas as well, particularly maybe ones that people haven't seen before. Here's quite a classic. Many of you probably have seen is a sand mandala. For those who haven't seen one before, this is a mandala where all the outlines are drawn in chalk on a background, and then all the spaces are filled in with sand. And if I zoom in, just to the point where it starts to pixelate, might be not so clear on your own screen. But all these colors are actually colored sand particles. It's an incredibly skillful process. I mean, it blows my mind. It's bad enough painting them, but to actually do this in sand, it's completely mind-blowing. I think I've got there's a detail picture. So you can even see how the sand is kind of piled up. It's not just kind of one flat layer. So traditionally, these are made for a specific purpose or at a specific occasion, especially a specific event. And at the end, all of the sand particles are swept into the middle. Where it just becomes this conglomerate gray mass of sand, all the colors just kind of mix together and become basically gray. And then the sand is ceremonially dumped, normally into a moving body of water, so a river, or if you haven't got a river, maybe a lake or an ocean or whatever is sort of convenient. Sort of showing the impermanence of the whole thing. So there's a sand mandala. They're really beautiful. If you should ever get the opportunity to see one being made, and occasionally you get, not during lockdown times, but occasionally you might get a group of monks coming from one of the big monasteries who may come to sort of museums, art galleries, different places around the world, where they might offer the opportunity to see a sand mandala being made. And I thoroughly recommend it. It's just incredible process. Other mandalas, many of you will know. Well, let's go here. This building in Kathmandu is the Bodhanath Stupa. So most people know it from Sidon. I found this rather amazing aerial image. And we can see the arrangement, the shapes of the walls. If you follow this kind of stepped arrangement all the way around, and then there are actually three levels of these steps. Now, if you can't see it, I've got this rather amazing image somewhere here. So this is the floor plan of the Bodhanath Stupa. And here, if you we can trace these lines round. And what this is actually each one of these three levels is actually three mandalas that are overlapping. So if you can all see my mouse pointer, okay, there's one is this vertical oblong. That's one mandala palace. Then you've got this horizontal mandala palace going across here. And then in between, you've got a square mandala palace. So these are the mandalas of Yamantaka, Guhyasamaja, and Heruka Chakrasamvara. And all three are placed one on top of each other. So incredibly powerful. And then this is repeated. Now, I'm not sure. You'd have to check with another source as to whether these outer two levels are the same three mandalas repeated, or whether there are actually maybe nine different mandalas stacked on top of each other. That I'm not sure of. Maybe that's one to check for yourself. But it's a amazing. Many of you maybe have been to Bodhanath Stupa. If you go in the future, if you go again, just have that in mind. There's all these mandala palaces. This is sort of the basis of this stupa. Another similar one is in Indonesia. This is the stupa at Borobudur in the jungles of Indonesia. And again, this is the same stepped pattern. You can see around these walls is all the stepped design again. And then in the middle, these are the thrones with the Buddha in the middle and all the retinue deities represented by stupas all the way around. This is huge. I don't know if that's a, I mean, these are staircases going up, so you can kind of get an idea of, you know, if a person's standing on these staircases, you could get an impression of how big this is, but it is absolutely huge. And a similar one again, this is maybe if any of you have been to Tibet, this is in Gyantse. This is the Kumbum stupa. And again, it's the same stepped idea, three mandalas overlapping each other in the different levels with a huge, this is the bumpa, the vase, and the spire on the top. And you can see how big this is. This was built in about, I think, the 13th century. Could be wrong, but around there. Friends of mine went to measure it up for the Great Stupa project at Bendigo in Australia, where they're building the Stupa of Great Compassion. And it's the same design as this Gyantse Stupa. So they went to measure up this one, and they found there's no measurement that actually matches. Everything's out. There's no straight lines anywhere. There's no measurements that actually match each other. It was just built brick by brick, with a sort of vague idea of where they were going, obviously with an idea of what a mandala looked like and where they were going, but certainly no architectural plans like we know them today. So yeah, it's really kind of a definitely a 13th century building, this one. But incredibly beautiful. And inside is all individual rooms, each of which are filled with statues and tankas. The whole place is just an absolute reliquary of Buddhist images. Incredible place. So that's some other mandalas. I've got that one again. We saw this one yesterday, the three-dimensional mandala. Again, if you get the opportunity to see one of these in the flesh, spend some time with it. Really sort of have a look at all the detail. Take what knowledge you've already got and try to sort of see, particularly if you're a meditator, a practitioner of these, using mandalas in your meditation. Nothing quite like actually seeing one of these for your study purposes. And then this is the classic. So this is the mandala of the Buddha Kala Chakra. Incredibly complex. I mean, way beyond what we've been looking at so far. I am not and never have been a practitioner of Kala Chakra, so I don't know too much about this particular mandala, but there are so many retinue deities where we have the main deity in the center, but then surrounded on all sides. These are just sort of brief representations of wheels. Of each of these wheels contains different retinues of deities. So there are hundreds of figures to visualize within this mandala. Incredibly complex. If you are a practitioner of Kala Chakra, I bow down before you. It's wonderful that we have the choices. The very simplest mandalas through to these incredibly complex that suits all abilities and propensities, and we can just find the one that really sort of works with us and for us. A couple of other things to show you. The cross vajra. So we only saw one with a mandala palace sitting on the front, and kindly shared her cross vajra that she has at home yesterday. But here's a picture of a cross vajra. It's highly symbolic in itself. Is the subject of a completely another weekend course, which I hope to be able to offer maybe later on. The symbolism of the vajra and the bell as well. In fact, I should have shown you the bell, shouldn't I? Because that's another.
Oh.
Will people see? No. Okay. We'll leave the bell. But the bell is a whole nother mandala as well. Take a look at your bell if you're an owner of a bell. Check out the sides of the bell. You'll find all the features of the mandala are there. But that's for another time. We'll cover that on another day. Then a good illustration, talking about the five Buddha families. And we mentioned Sambhogakaya and Nimanakaya, and we said the Nimanakaya was this, the five Buddha families appearing in this, is Buddha Shakyamuni, appearing in this aspect of a robed monk. This we sort of is the normal way that we depict the what's called the Nimanakaya, or emanation body of the Buddha. The Sambhogakaya, which is the literally translated the complete enjoyment body, is very different. No robes. Really, it's an enjoyment body. They're dressed to party, basically. So they've put on their glad rags. They've got their silk skirts and scarves and jeweled ornaments. It's a body of enjoyment. So it expresses delight, it expresses joy. Part of that is this crown containing five jewels. And these represent the five wisdoms of the five Buddha families. So, and in their appropriate colors. So we have red jewel in the center as being Amitabha, the wisdom of discrimination, Amoghasiddhi, the all-accomplishing wisdom, Ratnasambhava, the wisdom of equality, the blue Buddhakshobhya, wisdom of the Dhammadhatu, and the white Buddha of Arachana, who is the mirror-like wisdom. So this is kind of putting on display the fact that the Buddhas have overcome the delusions, each of the five main delusions, that they're saying that they've proudly stating, I have overcome these delusions. They're wearing their delusions as jewels, having overcome them. So it's not a case of kind of pretending that they never had delusion or hiding them away. This is kind of putting on display that the delusions have been transformed through wisdom. And then the other thing I wanted to show you. So for those of you who are familiar with the Lama Chöpa practice, this is the field of merit, is the visualization for all of the deities associated with Lama Chöpa. Here in the center, Lama Losang Tobang Dorji Chang, who's an aspect of Jetsong Karpa. But what I really wanted to show you is down here, at the bottom, on the throne, just get it over a little bit, we have four figures. There's one over here, number two, number three, and number four. These are the four guardian kings. I can zoom in. I found a delightfully high resolution image, luckily. I really had trouble finding images of these. So in our mandala, in each of the gateways, we had these guardian kings, the stupa, the sword, the lute-like instrument, and the victory banner with a mongoose, jewel-spitting mongoose. And these actually represent these four guardian kings. So here's the sword, the first one. Here he's playing this, it's either a veena, it's called a veena, but it's very much like a lute. There's also an instrument called a tampura, which is a very similar depiction. Here's in his right hand, there's a staff, and on the top is the victory banner. And in the, just on his left forearm, there is actually a mongoose here. I can see it because I know what I'm looking at, but it's actually quite difficult to see. But there is a mongoose here who is spitting out jewels. It's a very common image, a jewel-spitting mongoose. And then finally, we have, here's the stupa held up in his right hand. So these are the four guardian kings. So you quite often find them at in front of a temple, in front of a gompa, as being the guardians of the temple. I was trying to find, I've got a picture of my teacher's monastery in India, at Vajravidya, at the deer park in Sarnath. And there's a frieze on a wall, a kind of three-dimensional kind of depiction of these. And I've got a photograph of it somewhere, but I'm afraid I could not find it. But I remember that they're there. So next time you're in Lama Chöpa, remember your four guardian kings down here. That's a whole nother teaching as well. The Lama Chopa Field of Merit. So we won't go there. So yes, thought it would be interesting just to show you those as being other types of mandalas, and also just some things that we've mentioned that I didn't have decent images of, but you can see them there now. Okay, so I thought I would try to finish the teachings today with trying to pull everything together, trying to have an idea of how we can take this forward and put it into practice, use it in our daily lives. It shouldn't just be an object of knowledge. It shouldn't just be an interesting weekend that you spent on Zoom. Neither should it be sort of something left to being an academic sort of pursuit, something to be studied. This is something that we can definitely put into practice that should help us in terms of progressing on the spiritual path, dealing with our negative emotions, our delusions, and setting us up for some sort of happiness in the future, whether that be in terms of fortunate rebirths, liberation, or at the very most, full enlightenment for the benefit of all. But hopefully we can put into practice what we've learned and bring about those results. So wanted to just really cover those a bit this afternoon. I thought we'd probably finish a little bit early, if that's okay with you. But also I wanted to leave space, about some time for questions at the end as well. So maybe I'll talk for maybe about half an hour, and then we'll have maybe half an hour or so of questions. Hopefully you're bristling with questions. And then we'll do a final dedication and finish there for the afternoon, for the weekend. So how to put this into practice? Well, really what we've been talking about, the generation of ourselves in the form of a deity and seeing our environment as being a pure environment as a mandala, comes under the sort of skillful means, or the skillful methods that we normally call divine pride and clear appearance. So ordinarily we think of pride as being a negative emotion, a delusion, something that gives rise to suffering or causing harm. But here we talk about divine pride, which is a completely different basis. So ordinarily we develop pride on the basis of ordinary thoughts, ordinary elements, ordinary aggregates. And I think we mentioned yesterday, in terms of the Vajrayana path, we say that this ordinary view is the very cause of samsara. If we conceive, or if things appear to us as being ordinary, so we look at our own body and we think, I have an ordinary body. If we then strongly conceive of that body to be ordinary, then it is ordinary. And everything we do with that body, everything we think with that mind that we consider as being ordinary, and is therefore, at the very best, setting us up for future rebirth within samsara. Even if we sort of act with compassion and patience and love, even if we are well motivated if we regard everything as being ordinary, then at the very best, we're setting ourselves up for future samsaric rebirth. It's not a cause for liberation or enlightenment. It's only by lessening and eventually dropping this attitude of ordinariness, whereby we start to create the causes for us to be liberated from samsara and to gain full enlightenment. So we say in the Vajrayana, we say that this is the very root of the problem, is ordinary conception and ordinary appearance. So we use the meditations on generating ourselves as a deity and our environment as the deity, as the mandala, in order to overcome both ordinary appearance and ordinary conception. If we can begin to imagine ourselves, remember this is a path, we have to start somewhere. So at the beginning, it's very much in our imagination, but we can begin immediately to start with our conception. What appears to us isn't going to change very much, maybe to start with, but how we conceive of things can start to change immediately, straight away. We can start to change our attitude, the way that we see the world and ourselves. And by regarding ourselves as the deity and our environment as being the mandala, we don't look at our body and immediately start to think this is the body of a deity, okay? Because we are stuck at the moment with ordinary aggregates, ordinary elements. So we don't immediately try to imagine that our current physical body is the body of a deity. There are means within tantric practice by which we imagine that everything becomes emptiness to start with, that we dissolve everything that we sort of experience at the moment, everything we see, feel, hear, touch, we can dissolve everything into emptiness, by which I mean that we can bring to mind the teachings that nothing exists in the way that it appears. And if we start actually looking at the way in which, say, our body exists, we don't find any basis for existence. Okay, there's an unfindability of the body that we call the body. It's a convenient term. We can still call it a body because it's, you know, we have to refer to it somehow. And when I speak to somebody else about my body, then it's a convenient way of labeling something. But it's what we're saying is it's not really anything more substantial than that. One of the reasons we call it conventional truth, we can refer to a body, and we call it a conventional truth. Well, it's conventional in that it is a convention. When I say my body, you know what I mean. I know what I mean when you say your body. So we can call that conventional truth. But when we go looking for anything underneath that, anything more substantial, anything more fundamental, we don't find it. What we find is a lack of true existence of the body. And this is one way in which we can approach this dissolution of our concepts of body and environment and me and all these things. We can dissolve them into emptiness. And in that space of emptiness, then anything's possible. I think emptiness is one way of saying this infinite field of possibility. We hopefully have created causes for anything to occur. And it's within that space of emptiness, the Dharma Dhatu, that anything can occur. So we can, with the appropriate initiation, with the appropriate teachings, the methods, then we can, from that state of emptiness where anything is possible, well, instead of coming back in an ordinary body into an ordinary environment, why don't we try arising in the form of a pure being in a pure environment? It's just as valid. There is definitely a basis for that to happen. It's not, we say it's imagination, and it is to start with, but it's correct imagination. It's not imagining unicorns and fairies and things that don't exist. Sorry, fairies and unicorns. I've just said you don't exist. Sorry about that. But you know what I mean. Yeah, it's not a fairy tale. It is correct imagination. So we can, because we have arisen from emptiness, which is by nature completely pure, then the deity and the environment that we arise as has as its essential nature purity rather than contamination, which is the state of our current aggregates, our body and our mind and our environment. So this is why I say we can't impute, we can't think of ourselves as a deity on the basis of our current body or our environment as being a pure environment on the basis of the current impure environment that we live in. First of all, we have to dissolve all those concepts of impurity, of contamination, and the objects themselves, our body and the environment. We dissolve everything into emptiness, into the space of the Dhammadhatu, from which arises this pure body, pure mind, pure speech, and pure environment, along with pure enjoyments and pure activities as well. One of the ways in which, again, we can describe the Vajrayana is the effect vehicle. We say there are four effects that we bring about through this meditation. And this is purity of body, of enjoyments, of environment, and activities. These four effects. So this is what we're bringing about. But we need this emptiness as being the basis. Everything arises from this emptiness. Without that, we're just playing. It's just a game. It's not going to achieve anything. It's kind of incorrect. It's like a child at play. It's fun, but it serves no real purpose in terms of a spiritual path. So the whole thing needs to be underpinned by our understanding of emptiness and also our ability to sort of put that understanding really into practice. The better our experience of emptiness, then the more authentic can be our visualization or becoming of a deity and in mandala, out of the space of emptiness. The better the emptiness, the better the manifestation from the emptiness. So it's very, very important to have that understanding. Mainly that's through the sutra teachings. The view of emptiness is exactly the same in Tantra as it is in Sutra. But the emptiness tends not to be described so completely as it is in the Sutra teachings. So particularly the second turning of the Wheel of Dharma, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and the commentaries and treatises that were later written. That's where we study emptiness. And the better understanding that we can have from there, we can then bring into our tantric practice. So this was the way that Jason Karpa really recommended that we go about our practice of Tantra, was to really have firm foundation in emptiness. Also, compassion. Our whole motivation for doing this type of practice, for becoming a deity, for generating ourselves in the space of a mandala. Why are we doing this? It's so that, remember, we come back to this thought of bodhicitta, where we develop the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. So again, the stronger our compassionate motivation can be, then the better will our meditation be as well. If we are absolutely desperate to work for the benefit of others, then we will be equally desperate for our meditation to work, our tantric meditation to bear fruit. So again, it's this reliance on wisdom, emptiness, and compassion that gives the driving force. And then underpinning all that is renunciation. Okay, we're not going to develop compassion if we haven't first got renunciation. Renunciation is almost like compassion for ourselves. Okay, compassion, bodhicitta, is compassion directed towards other sentient beings. Our wish to relieve their suffering, a wish to bring them happiness. Well, renunciation is that same kind of thought directed to ourselves. Renunciation, we can say, is we don't want more suffering. We want happiness. Okay, and it's a turning away from creating causes for suffering and a turning towards creating the causes for happiness for ourselves. So this, we can say, renunciation is almost like compassion for ourselves. And it becomes, it underpins the compassion and the wisdom. This is why there are these protection circles at the outside of the mandala. Remember, we looked at those yesterday. As a little aside for Anne's question this morning, I think it was, about the fact that the flames go all the way around the sphere of the mandala, as do the vajras, but we were wondering about the lotus petals. We had a little bit of discussion at lunchtime, actually, and what we thought was that there, in the descriptions of the mandalas, there is this kind of a wall of flames that is the sphere, and there is a wall of vajras that kind of protect from outside influences. But within that sphere is the circle of the five wisdom fires, flames, and the circle of vajras, and then the circle of lotus petals. But they don't go all the way around. They are circles, but they're within separate spheres of vajras and flames that are there to protect from outside influences. We say from demons or maras. So they're kind of slightly different, and they're not depicted on a normal sort of image of a mandala. But you'll find in the commentaries, whatever your main practice is, if you check out a really detailed commentary, you'll find that this outer sphere of flames, it's not only flames, there's arrows flying through it and other weapons. But it's a different level. It's not the five wisdom flames, the five colored flames that we looked at. It's a separate sphere. So that kind of hopefully is an answer for that one. I've gone off topic. Ordinary appearance and conception is where we were. And then bringing it to divine pride and clear appearance. So divine pride, we're saying, is not a deluded pride. So now hopefully we can see now how that is not deluded. So ordinary pride, we develop in reliance on these contaminated aggregates, contaminated body, contaminated mind, and the pride that we might develop because it's based on these contaminated aggregates is contaminated. It is delusional pride. The kind of pride that we develop as a deity is not based in delusion. It's based on a pure view, purified aggregates, because we have been through this process of dissolution into emptiness and then arising in the pure form of a deity. So whatever mental activity we have is by nature pure. Again, like I say in the beginning, this is imagined, but as we progress, as we develop further, then this becomes our reality. And the pride that we develop there, divine pride, is the pride that encourages our Buddha nature to ripen. Because we say, I am the deity. I am Chakrasambhara. I am Vajrabhārava. I am Chenrezig. I am whichever deity we have arisen in the form of. We say, I am that. This is me. So it is a kind of pride, but it's a pride that is based on a pure motivation and a pure set of aggregates. So it's a divine pride. And it's this that starts to chip away at this ordinary appearance and ordinary conception. The more firmly we can believe I am the deity, then we no longer see our body as being contaminated. We see it as being a pure body. When we look at our levels of consciousness, our mind, then we see that as pure mind. When we look at our environment, we see it as pure environment. I was thinking of the Chenrezi Sadhana. I think it's probably in other places, obviously, as well. But at the very end of the Chenrezi forearm, Chenrezi Sadhana, we say all forms are manifestations of Arya Chenrezi. All sounds are manifestations of the six letter mantra. And all mental activity arises from great exalted wisdom. And this is kind of what we carry forward from the meditation into our day. If we do our practice, say, first thing in the morning, we spend an hour practicing our sadhana, we then have 23 hours to get through until we next maybe focus ourselves on the meditation aspect. So what we can take with us through the day is this just constantly nudging us ourselves, reminding ourselves, I am the deity. Everything I hear is the sound of the mantra. All the thoughts I have, all the levels of mental activity, actually this is just great exalted wisdom manifesting in the form of all the different thoughts I have. And this, as I say, it chips away. It's a path, it's a progression. It's something we need to go through step by step, that eventually this conviction becomes stronger and stronger. This aspect of divine pride, and it is there designed to overcome principally this ordinary conception. We can start to let that go. And in doing so, we're letting go of what we've already established as being the cause of samsara, the cause of all our suffering. We are directly applying the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, true paths. We are on that path, heading towards true cessations. We're directly uprooting the causes of samsara. So we can feel pretty good about that. We should rejoice, definitely. So the other aspect, we have divine pride, then we have clear appearance. So This is maybe more focused on our environment. So it's seeing everything as being manifestation of yourself as the deity. So everyone else we meet, all the other people we meet around us, we can regard as being the deity as well. The place where we live, or the place where we are, is the mandala. So everything around us, all the objects and the enjoyments of the mandala, perfectly pure, all having arisen from this state of emptiness, from the Dharmadhatu. So they have this aspect of complete purity. And actually they will use the words in the tantric literature of they should delight the senses. I mean, imagine going through your day where just everything delights your senses. I mean, how wonderful. And many of the tantric literature talks about not being afraid of delusion either. So if we feel attachment arising, we need to skillfully bring that within our sphere of meditation, but we shouldn't turn away from it. It's not something there to be antidoted, as in the Hinayana. Okay, on the Hinayana, when attachment arises, we might meditate on the disgusting nature of the human body. We think of all of its bodily secretions, and one really effective meditation is to imagine if you sort of attracted to, in a bad way, lusting after a particular person, just imagine them having transparent skin. So you get to see all their blood vessels and their tendons and their muscles and organs, and yuck. You're still attached to them, you're still lusting after. No, I don't think so. But that's applying an antidote. That's not the path here. The path here is bringing delusion onto the path, of using it as the fuel for the fire. So the teachers have always said we should not be afraid of delusion. We should, like the image of Waitara I showed you before, wearing her 5 jeweled crown, that our delusion should be not necessarily proudly on display to others, because this should be a secret practice. Okay, it's secret as in that we keep it to ourselves. We don't publish what we're doing to other people, but as an internal process, then what we're doing is going, okay, attachment arising. Here's something I can use. This isn't boring. This is real fuel for the fire. This is where the action is. This is where I'm going to enjoy the practice. So it takes courage. It takes great skill. This is one reason why the tantric path is the secret path. It's not just attachment either, anger. So a lot of the deities in the tantric practice are very wrathful deities, like Yamantaka, very good at taking this energy of anger. And again, not applying antidotes to it. You want the energy. That's the fuel for the fire. So we have to be very skillful. We don't allow anger to arise in an ordinary way. But remember, we're not ordinary now. We are the deity. So when the energy of anger starts to arise, this is what we can bring onto the spiritual path. This is what we can use to increase our wisdom, increase our compassion, the bliss and the emptiness. So these are all skillful methods. So the clear appearance aspect also has the idea of being able to place our mind. So we often talk about the development of two things in meditation, of calm abiding, shabata, or it's called shine in Tibetan. So it's the ability to perfectly place our mind in equipoise. There are different levels of being able to place our mind. There's been some excellent retreats with Venerable Mary Reavy through Land of Joy. There's one again next year, I think. And other retreats and teachers who teach us very well. Not a subject we're going to teach today, but we have to, as part of our practice, we need to be able to focus on ourselves as the deity and the mandala as a whole, and hold that feeling and that image in this mind of equipoise, in this placement meditation. And we need to build up to this ability. So we begin with maybe visualizing, I think I said this morning, maybe the eyes of the deity, and building up with the face and the rest of the body, and then the features of the mandala. And gradually we build up a complete image of the deity and the mandala, maybe with 492 different retinue deities as well, all of which have different colored segments to their fingers and wearing different ornaments and different hand mudras. And yes, lots and lots and lots to visualize. But we can, this is a skill. I always use the analogy of learning to play the violin. I learned to play the violin when I was a child. And of course, when I started playing, it sounded like I was treading on a cat. But of course, you practice, you use those words, constant repetition. This is what my violin teacher always used to tell me, constant repetition. You do it again and again and again and again. And eventually you start to be able to play beautiful music that fills people with pleasure, hopefully. And it's the same with our meditation. It's something that we have to work at. Doesn't come naturally to most people. Maybe we have tremendous imprints from previous lives, and maybe we find visualization or meditation very easy. That's wonderful. For the rest of us, it's a ongoing process, just something that we have to practice each day. And we can use this image of the deity and the mandala for our tranquil abiding, calm abiding meditation practice. We use the form of the deity and the mandala as being our object of meditation. And then there are different levels. We talk about the gross parts of the mandala and the deity. So the sort of things that we've been sort of mainly covering. But then we also talk about the subtle parts of the mandala as well, and the deity. And there comes a point where we're able to visualize very clearly, like it's right in front of us. Like we can see with our own eyes immediately what's in front of us. We are eventually able to see ourselves as the form of the deity and the mandala around us, as though it were just right there in front of our eyes. Very clear. But this can take a long time. But we need to just apply ourselves to the practice of that. So these two, divine pride and clear appearance, they're the two main techniques that we employ, certainly on the first stage, the generation stage of tantric practice, whereby we start to make definite inroads into overcoming these causes of samsara, of ordinary appearance and ordinary conception. So you can see the methods, hopefully, using divine pride and clear appearance. We can definitely start to work with ordinary conception. We can do that immediately. And then as our visualization improves, as our conviction becomes stronger in what we're doing, then eventually what appears to our senses may also begin to take on a whole new cast, a whole new color of some level of purity. And we eventually, we completely believe ourselves to be the deity living in the space of the mandala. And it's at this point that we would transfer our practice to the second stage of highest yoga tantra, what we call the completion stage, Dzogchen, which we're not going to talk about now, but there is a level, so far as I say, this has all been basically a contrived or imagined practice. But when we start on the completion stage, then the mandala becomes a very internal thing. And we see it in a completely different way, because it's then composed of the bodily elements of our subtle body, our divine body, which I don't want to go too far into, but channels, winds, drops, all of these subtle elements of our vajra body, our spiritual body. We begin to work directly with these, and this actually becomes the cause for us developing what we call the illusory body and the clear light mind, through which we develop the body and mind of a Buddha directly. So these are the actual methods for achieving the body and mind of a Buddha, completely not within the scope of this weekend's teaching, but just to point out how working with the mandala and seeing ourselves as the deity, where that fits in to the stages of the of a practice that leads us to completely through to full enlightenment. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself, but it's a very large part of the tantric path. So that's divine pride and clear appearance. I think let's go back to this Lama Yeshe's statement of that this mandala, including the deity, is as being a quote vision of totality, which we mean the totality of our experience. So this is kind of a summing up, really. Now let's bring it all together. So we have the opportunity to bring into effect methods by which we can create a better world for ourselves and others, based on a shift in our attitude. As long as we believe that we're ordinary and that we live in ordinary circumstances, then we will stay ordinary. That will be the totality of our experience. So through these methods that the Buddha has given us, we are able to shift that attitude. We begin to be able to break down this ordinariness and for things to take on an essential purity. And if the essence is pure, then everything that manifests from that essence will also be pure. So we're being given the tools to be able to create a future for ourselves that is free of suffering. We can achieve a true cessation. And the purpose for us doing that is so that we can then bring all other beings to that same state. This is our essential motivation. Always comes back to bodhicitta. I think all of the great teachers always say this. It's bodhicitta is always the very center of things. Because it encompasses all of our wishes and all of the wishes of all other living beings as well. So this beneficial attitude of bodhicitta is at the very heart of everything. So in terms of our daily life, if we have a tantric practice, then we have the teachings that we need. We can try to gain as much experience as we can through the meditations. We can try to do as much retreat as we can. It's through retreat where we can really immerse ourselves in the practice. Whether that be what we call a nearing retreat, where we count maybe thousands of the deity's mantra, or whether it's more of an experiential retreat on the sadhana, where we might emphasize different parts of the sadhana on different days during the retreat, just to gain more and more familiarity with the techniques. So there are different types of retreat that we can do, but it is through retreat that we bring ourselves closer and closer to our goal. We can't spend our whole life in retreat, however much we would like to, some of us. Other people, it might scare you to think of too much retreat, but if we can't spend our life in retreat, we have other commitments, we have family, we have career. It's not appropriate for us to disappear to a cave and just do retreat. So we need to apply these methods in daily life. Well, that's entirely possible too. And this is especially important to remember these aspects of divine pride and clear appearance. We can remind ourselves at various times during the day. Some people say, find something that happens quite often. Say every time you make a cup of tea, or every time you sneeze, remember bodhicitta, remember, regenerate yourself as the deity. Find something that just repeats itself a few times during the day, and hook onto that, this reminder to yourself to remind yourself that you are the deity. Remind yourself that you are surrounded by pure environment, pure enjoyments. All beings around you are deities and gods and goddesses, and all the sound you hear is mantra. There's a lovely one, actually. It's in one of the handouts I'll share with you, but the Mandala Palace has little bells hanging all around the walls, and they resound with the sound of emptiness. It's like teachings on emptiness coming from these bells. You also find them normally on stupas as well, hanging as an umbrella at the very top of a stupa, and they normally have little bells hanging on them. And as the wind blows and the bell rings, it's meant to remind you of emptiness. So yeah, every time you hear a bird singing, just imagine that it's your guru or the Buddha's appearing in this form of a bird, giving teachings on emptiness. It's wonderful. So this is how we can take it forward. Even it's difficult to maybe remain in the form of a deity when you're, you know, busy in the office or cooking in the kitchen. You've got all these arms to try and cope with while you're trying to, you know, boil pasta or something. Well, think of emptiness, think of compassion, think of renunciation. These are these three essential principles that underpin all of the tantric practice. So they're much easier ways in which we can make our practice, again, authentic and genuine, by really shoring up our foundations. We're making sure that the foundations on which we build our tantric practice, this renunciation, wisdom, and compassion, make sure they're really strong. So again, if we find it difficult to imagine ourselves as the deity, or our environment as the mandala, then we can definitely bring these thoughts into our day, developing compassion, developing renunciation, seeing suffering for what it is. It's suffering. And I don't want that anymore. I don't want suffering. I want something better than that. So we turn away from maybe things that might create suffering for ourselves in the future, and we go and do something more virtuous instead. That's a really practical way. Another way is rejoicing. We often say rejoicing. Lama Zopa Rinpoche says rejoicing is the best and easiest practice that we can do. We can do that in bed. We can do that in a hammock. We don't need to be doing anything, but we can just think, wow. Wow, wow, wow. All these holy beings who appear and give teachings relentlessly and tirelessly. His Holiness the Dalai Lama just gives so many teachings now. It's just fantastic. Rejoice. Rejoice in your own practice, especially. We have to feel like our practice is something that we want to do. And if we're going to rejoicing in what we do, then it'll encourage us to come back and do some more because it makes us happy. Jason Karpa always used to say, basically, I'm sure he didn't put it in these words, but quit while you're ahead. So don't let your practice become dull and jaded and that you're bored. Stop well before that point. And then it makes you want to come back for more. It's like, oh, I feel like I could do another 10 minutes meditation. No, stop. And then you'll actually kind of go, oh, I really want to get back to meditating because you've quit while you're ahead. Yeah, don't wait until you can't meditate anymore because you're so tired. You won't come back to it. You'll think, oh, it's that meditation. That's the thing that makes me really tired, isn't it? And it can put us off. So many skillful means that we can employ. But the very best of them is remember yourself as the deity. Remember everything around you, all your environment as being perfectly pure mandala, filled with enjoyments that delight the senses, gods and goddesses, and the sound of the Dharma resounding around you. If we can do that, then our practice becomes absolutely solid and will achieve the result. It is said within one short human lifetime, or at least within 7, 14, or 21 lives, which in the great scheme of things is nothing. So yes, we rejoice. And I think I'm going to stop there. I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. If people have questions, we could open the chat, which Faye is very kindly now doing. Or if you have questions to ask out loud. Joe, is that you with your hand up there? Yes, let's go with Joe.
Apologies if this is slightly trivial, but I was curious about the jewel spitting mongoose.
All right.
Which rather amused me, but I'm sure it's not meant to be amusing.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to, in one way, I rationalised it by mongoose, generally deal with cobras or other dangerous snakes without having any poison harm them. And I just had this imagination of the poison turning into jewels, hence spitting the jewels out. But I dare say that is so off the actual reason that they are giving gems.
No, I don't think that is far off, actually. The mongoose, I think you would have to have grown up in an Indian culture, which I haven't, to probably have a better idea of the cultural significance of the mongooses. But I know that they are regarded as a very, like a totem sort of animal. Yeah. In the West, maybe we talk about dragons and unicorns and, you know, sort of mythical beasts as having great power, or, you know, you could say that sort of, you know, lions and tigers have this energy of being, you know, sort of king of the jungle, or so definitely there are energies associated with different animals. And I know, like you say, the mongoose, yes, animal that can take on extremely poisonous snakes, that it can not suffer harm from poison itself. So it's obviously a very powerful animal. You know, it must have had a lot of significance placed to it. So I don't think you're far off. The fact that it's jewel spitting, or in some texts it actually uses the words jewel vomiting, which is even more amusing. I'm not entirely sure, but yes, transforming poison into jewels, much like a peacock. You know, a peacock eats poisonous plants, and then the poisons that it ingests get secreted in the feathers, and that's what gives them this iridescent beauty to their feathers. So there's this transformation of poison into beauty. Maybe it's the same with the mongoose as
Thank
well.
You.
Sure. Anybody else? Yes, Tim.
Hello again.
Hello.
I have perhaps an interesting question, a little bit technical.
Sure.
It's always nice to hear the story about the proportions of the Buddha's body and how that came about. It's always nice to hear that story for, you know, tanka painters.
Yes.
So when it comes to mandala, is there a similar story? Because it's a much more complex subject, I know, but is there some way of tracing, I'm thinking lineage.
Yes.
Of mandalas.
Okay.
So this is, we're basing everything in the course on the Tibetan view or the Tibetan way of seeing things. And I know mandalas, they must go back a very long time.
Yes.
But as far as Tibetan mandalas, is there a way of saying how the actual geometry, the proportions, the structures, like the blueprint, is there a way of tracing that?
Yes, there is. So in the Vajrayana tradition, the teaching is that it was the Buddha who gave the tantric teachings, and that when he gave tantric teachings, he arose in the form of the deity that he was teaching, and that he emanated the mandala around him. So in some of the tantras, the proportions of the mandala are actually given explicitly. normally measured in cubits. So it's this elbow to fingertip, or we use finger widths as well. Spans. All the measurements were given normally in terms of cubits because they're quite big measurements. For maybe some of the mandalas, they may have arisen through the individual experience of tantric yogis. So, for instance, one of the story that I know, the great Mahasiddhan Naropa meditated upon Vajrayogini, in which she appeared in a very specific form. So the whole tradition of that particular form of Vajrayogini, Naropa's Dakini, is really based on his experience, his vision. So I think when the mandala is described, it's really coming from the vision of Naropa. But we regard Naropa as an enlightened being. So in essence, the teaching is being given by the Buddha, not necessarily Buddha Shakyamuni, but a fully enlightened Buddha nonetheless. So this is, there's these two ways that we can think. Another thing to consider also is when, especially in the terms of the Chakrasambhara mandala, so when the Buddha taught most of the tantras, he reabsorbed the mandala at the end of the teaching. So for like Yamantaka, Guhya Samaja, he reabsorbed the mandala. But with Chakrasambhara, he actually left the mandala in place. It's still there now. So for yogis with very pure vision, they can actually see the mandala. In India, there are the what are called the 24 holy places, and they correspond to points of the mandala, of Chakrasambhara's mandala. And they are, you can go and visit these places. It's a wonderful pilgrimage, especially for practitioners of that tantra. And if we have very pure view, then we can actually see these geographic places actually as points of the mandala, of Chakrasambhara's mandala. So maybe there's something from there as well, that people actually sort of experience the mandala in the meditation and are therefore able to pass this on in an authentic way. But I think ultimately it all stems from Buddha Shakyamuni.
And so would that mean that the Tibetan tradition has simply carried on with the same proportions as we do today with the proportions of painting the deities?
Yes, that's true as far as I know. I mean, we talk about the Tibetan tradition. Actually, most of it actually come from India, especially the great monastic universities, Nalanda, Vikramashila. Where, for it, just as a for instance, the Guhya Samaja Tantra, it was Nagarjuna who wrote very extensive commentary. So he was, what, first century AD, I think. So well before, 600 years before Buddhism ever went to Tibet, there were very, very extensive explanations of the Guhya Samaja Tantra, which would have included all of the proportions of the mandala. I think it was probably standardized within Tibetan Buddhism. It's interesting to look at the Nyingma, the very earliest forms of mandalas, and the mandalas from the later schools, the Sama traditions, Gelug, Kagyu, and Sakya traditions, that you can sort of see some evolution. But then different premise as well, because the Nyingma relied principally on the Dzogchen teachings, and the Sama traditions rely on the later commentaries and teachings. So you can see some evolution in there. also the Nepali depictions as well. So lots of the Sakya tradition, actually, a lot of that is influenced by the Kathmandu Valley, the Newar tradition. So you look at the Newari forms of Buddhist art, and again, there are differences. But then equally, you can really see the similarities in both deities and mandalas. So even though it was from a different time and a different place, you can really see how they're interconnected. And whilst there are cultural differences, but there are the same with the Buddha image as well. You know, you go to Thailand, you sort of see the elongated topknot as a flame. And in Japan, it's very, the top of the Buddha's head very flat. It's only a very small dome. So there are definitely cultural differences, but equally there are, the proportions are generally identical, just slight kind of cultural differences. Even in coming to the West, you know, there's the way I paint, I'm not Tibetan, I'm not trying to be Tibetan. So the way I paint is how a Westerner sees, particularly like facial features. I paint as a Westerner, and that comes through in my painting. So, yeah. That's another reason why it's called the Wheel of Dharma, because it moves. It moves in time and space. It moved from India to Tibet and to China and Korea and Japan, now to the West. So, yeah, it fits into every culture, because every culture, we're always addressing the same problems, jealousy and anger and attachment. It's the same anywhere you go. But equally, we need to relate to the teachings in our own cultural idioms. Idioms. So, yeah, they take on slight differences. But there is a lineage. There is a tradition. There is traceability back to the time of the Buddha. Yes.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay. So we have one on chat. So reciting mantras to be used to remind us of a deity or the attributes of that deity, is it suitable for them to be repeated in daily life or reserved for formal practice? Good question. I think it's one answer might be it's about context. I think if you're out with the lads on a Friday night, probably don't say too many mantras out loud. Anyone at Land of Joy will tell you I'm constantly singing mantras when I'm cooking in the kitchen, as well as songs from my playlist, from iTunes as well. But yeah, sure, I sing mantras out loud as long as it's not disturbing other people. One of my teachers has said that actually singing a mantra with a blessed tune makes mantra recitation so much more powerful than reciting them mentally. So actually it's a really good idea to get the tunes for different mantras and to sing them when it's appropriate. In a group of teachings that's called Lojong in Tibetan, or mind training, one of the pieces of advice is to change our mind inwardly while remaining natural on the outside. We don't want to come over as being a weirdo. That's going to put people off the Dharma. But there's the thought of Barman, I'll have what he's drinking. People see us change for the better. People see us happy. People see us being able to cope with circumstances that maybe they think, whoa, I'd get so angry. What's his secret? What's she doing to give her that ability? So, yeah, there's an idea of changing our mind on the inside while remaining natural on the outside. But where appropriate, I think it's very, very powerful actually to recite mantras openly. Hey, if you're out for a walk in the countryside, you know, along the cliffs or through the woods or whatever, and there's no one around, then sing your heart out. It's wonderful. It's a really good practice. So we have another question on chat. No, we don't. It's the same one. Yep. No, that's fine. Do we have any other questions? No. Okay. So let's maybe just do another short meditation just to finish. And there'll be there'll just be a couple of finishing off details, but let's just do another short meditation to finish. So maybe let's make this about rejoicing. So maybe we think to ourselves, like, how many people in the world at this very moment are listening to Dharma teachings, working to improve their mind, working for the benefit of others, just in terms of numbers, we can think that we are extremely fortunate. If we think of how many people are listening to teachings on mandalas at this very moment, maybe, just maybe, we are, whatever it is, 10 people. In the whole world. What brought us here to this point? Was it random? Or was there some cause? If there was a cause, then how was this created? So many of the teachers say, if we want to know what we were doing in previous lives, we should look at this life. This life is the effect of all the causes that we created in previous lives. So we can rejoice that maybe in some past life, we created the cause, probably together, given that we've come together for these 2 days, to study these really rare, profound teachings of the Buddha. Maybe we all created the cause together in a previous life. How amazing, how wonderful. The teaching also says, if we want to know what we will be in our future lives, that again, we should look at this life. So the fact that we've all come together for this weekend, studying the extremely rare and profound teachings of the Buddha, we are again creating causes so that in the future, maybe in this life, maybe the next, maybe not for many lifetimes to come, but this cause that we are creating now will ripen only as happiness. Either some samsaric happiness, or depending on our motivation for the happiness and bliss of liberation and full enlightenment. So again, we can rejoice. How wonderful, how amazing. So bringing to mind all this positive energy we've created this weekend, we dedicate this to the long life, good health of our teachers, our gurus. May they continue to spread the stainless doctrine of Buddha for the benefit of all living beings. May all their compassionate activity never cease until samsara ends. And may all their holy wishes be spontaneously accomplished. So through this merit, may we all become guru deities ourselves and lead every living being without exception to that same state. May the precious supreme jewel of bodhicitta that has not arisen arise. And where it has arisen, may it flourish and increase forevermore. So we have now dedicated all our merit to the greatest of all purposes. And again, rejoice. Thank you very much.